together since, I think, first time actually I think we met was in 2006 in Crete, where I organized a session on quantum thermodynamics. He's one of the pioneers coming out of MIT on quantum thermodynamics. His PhD work, which he completed in 81, he started in 1980, completed his PhD in 1981. Okay, so that tells you a little bit about Professor Bonessa on quantum thermodynamics, where he basically came up with a new equation of motion, which takes the equation of motion of physics, in quantum physics, the Schrodinger equation, the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, is a special case of his equation, which allows one to look not just at the reversible type of processes, unitary processes you see in physics, but in fact all irreversible processes. And in fact, he's been the inspiration for a number of PhDs that I've graduated in my group. I've got another couple working in this area in quantum thermodynamics. Now, today, he is not going to talk about quantum thermodynamics, but in terms of some other work for which he just recently, by the way, won the ASME Society Edward F. Overton Award for the work that he's going to present today on combustion calculations, the kinetics of combustion calculations. He is now a professor at the University of Brescia. He's been there since 86, is that right? Since 86. Fortunately, we met in 2006. I've continued our collaboration, and I hope that you find this talk interesting. Okay.
Well, thank you, Michael, for a very kind introduction. You're always too kind with me, and thank you for having me here. That's the part of Italy where I come from. This is where Brescia is. Okay, so. All right. I'm going to talk about a way to simplify chemical kinetics in a way that allows you to make it tractable also to the non-expert in kinetics, like I am. I'm not an expert in chemical kinetics. This is a topic in which there are so many applications. The typical one is combustion. And you see here some applications, especially when combustion is coupled with fluid mechanics, and you want to solve in a detailed or direct numerical simulation flow field in which you have combustion and turbulence. The problem is still complicated, and even the powerful computers that we have difficulties in doing the job in reasonable times. But my hope is that now that we have also a lot of interest in bioapplication, biology. There are models in biochemistry that might profit of the method that I'm going to describe. Now, this is not new. It is one of my first scientific works. When I came as a graduate student to MIT to work for my master's degree with Professor James Keck. His first side assignment was to take a computer program that was used by many people at those times, and still today, which is the Gordon MacBride program to compute chemical equilibrium, and modified so as to implement the method that I am going to describe. At those times, this is how I looked, actually a couple of years later, because then this is, I think, is my graduation as a PhD, I think, considering the colors. And at those times, I was working with a computer program with punched cards. I don't know if you have you know that they existed. So it was about 2,000 lines, namely 2,000 cards in a box, which today would be about 60 kilobytes. At those times, it would be about 3 kilograms of things to carry around. Then time has gone by, and for a while, precisely because I'm not a chemical kinetics expert, I couldn't do much progress. But lately, I went back and visited Professor Keck before he passed away, and this is a photograph of when we were working on our last his last paper together on the topic. All right, I'm going to focus on an example just to fix ideas. So this example is the expansion of a gas in a supersonic shape, nozzle, with a shape studied so that at inlet, the throat is here, at inlet you have Mach 1 flow, with equilibrium composition, chemical equilibrium composition, and then the flow is subject to a rapid expansion, and as a result of the expansion being supersonic, the flow will accelerate to Mach 4, it will cool down from 3000 to 1000 K, and also the pressure will go down. So here's how the flow speed goes up and how the temperature goes down. I'm also going to focus on an example of a particularly simple substance, which is a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen, no nitrogen, and all the other species that enter in the chemical scheme, whereby you burn hydrogen in pure oxygen. So it's oxycombustion of hydrogen. So the scheme has 24 reactions and these 8 species. OO2, H, H2OH, H2O, HO2, and H2O2. Stoichiometry. When we have chemical reactions, we like to, balance the stoichiometric coefficients. So one way of writing the chemical reactions is this one, where you have oxygen, hydrogen, you have some subscripts that indicate how many atoms are in that molecule, and then you've got stoichiometric coefficients. With the plus is the forward, and with the minus is the reverse coefficient. And the difference between reverse and forward is the net coefficient of the reaction. If you use this kind of notation, you can use easily programs like Excel or MATLAB that allow you to work with vectors and matrices. And so this is a very handy formulation. Now, regarding the conservation of chemical elements, which is something that is what you do when you balance stoichiometric coefficients, you can write it this way. You can simply see in each of these species how many atoms of oxygen kind you have and how many atoms of hydrogen you have in each of these species. So this forms this little matrix. And actually, you can view that each column as a vector. And since I'm going to use geometry considerations, I'm spending a little time here to explain this vector notation. So this is the vector that represents the elemental compositions for oxygen content. And also the stoichiometric coefficients. Each chemical reaction has a list of stoichiometric coefficients that also can be viewed as vectors. There are eight numbers in this vector. There are eight numbers in that vector. And the condition of element conservation, because chemical reactions do not destroy elements, is that the scalar product of these two vectors, so this by that times the second plus the third times the third and so on, which is the result of which is here, be identically zero if the stoichiometric coefficients are balanced. Okay, so those vectors, you see, we have 24 vectors that represent the chemical species, the chemical reactions, and we have two vectors that represent the elements. The fact that they are orthogonal, element conservation, as we've said, the scalar product has to be zero, means that they are orthogonal. So so we can take, you have to think in terms of an eight-dimensional space, which is not easy to represent, as being split and or partitioned into in the direct sum of two subspaces. One in which all the stoichiometric coefficients lie, which is a six-dimensional space that here I represent as a plane. So all the stoichiometric coefficients lie in this plane, and the elemental vectors lie in this other, which is a plane. It's a two-dimensional subspace, but I indicate it as just a vector, just to make it. All right. Now, we said at the entrance, at the throat of the nozzle, we have equilibrium composition. How do we compute equilibrium composition according to thermodynamics? One way, one of the theorems that you have seen or you will see in your graduate thermodynamics course you are dealing with combustion is that when you are at equilibrium, the Gibbs free energy of the system is minimal, subject for a given temperature, for a given pressure, and for the given amount of elements present in the mixture. So the system at equilibrium chooses the composition that optimizes in the sense of minimizing the Gibbs free energy. And this minimum, and if you do the math, the minimum can be written as a necessary condition for equilibrium, which says that the chemical potentials of the various components, so there are eight species here, so there are eight chemical potentials, weighted by the stoichiometric coefficient of one reaction, each reaction, this sum has to be zero for each and every reaction. So it is necessary, so this is 24 equations. One for each reaction. Now let me define another, since these are another list of eight numbers, let's think of them again as vectors, another vector of eight numbers. And so let me define the chemical potential divided by RT and with a minus sign in front, which for those of you who have done thermodynamics, it's the partial derivative of the fundamental relation in entropy form with respect to the number of the amounts of constituent J. So you can think of it as the entropic chemical potential. So these entries form another vector that we can represent in the same space as before. Okay. All right. So now, we go back to the equations, and what happens here is that I have written these condition for equilibrium again as the scalar product of that lambda vector, chemical potentials, and the chemical reaction, the stoichiometric coefficient should be zero at equilibrium. So that means that the scalar product, so let's decompose our vector of chemical potentials in a component orthogonal to the plane where the hyperplane where the stoichiometric coefficients are, which we call sometimes is called the reactive plane, and the other part which is orthogonal to the inert space, which is that spanned by the elemental constraints. Okay. So. For the scalar product of lambda with every stoichiometric coefficient to be zero, we need the red component, the one here, to be null. So at equilibrium, so this is an equilibrium state. Chemical potentials are directed towards the inert space. Good. Okay, and that is our initial state, the state entrance state of the nozzle. Then as the flow expands, before I do that, if I have gases, I can write the chemical potentials in terms of the composition in the standard Gibbs-Dalton ideal model that you may be familiar if you've done thermodynamics. Okay, and therefore you with this from this equation you compute the equilibrium composition, the mole fractions. These x's are the mole fractions, the concentration of one element divided by the sum of the concentrations of the of all the species, one species. All right. And also, let me define what I would call, I will call the degree of disequilibrium. This will play a key role in the rest. Degree of disequilibrium is this expression here, the thing that was equal to zero at equilibrium, okay? We call it degree of disequilibrium of the reaction. It turns also out to be the logarithm of the ratio of the rate of the forward reaction to the divided by the reverse reaction. Okay. So that means that if I geometrically the degree of disequilibrium of a reaction will be given by the scalar product of lambda, stoichiometric coefficients, I'm sorry, lambda, the chemical potentials, and the stoichiometric coefficient of that reaction. So it's essentially the scalar product of this red vector, and the so the projection of the chemical potential on the reactive space, and that I will call lambda DOD. This also will play a role. So I take the chemical potential, I project them onto the space of stoichiometric coefficients, and that will give me, as you will see, important information. All right. So now, how do we solve for computing how the temperatures and compositions change along as you move downstream in this nozzle? I have to solve balance equations, and typically I have to solve mass balance, so continuity, momentum, energy balance, species concentrations. So I have to solve several differential equations. And even if I do, like we do in these examples, a one-dimensional model, so there is no flow field, the velocity is assumed to be uniform for every cross-section of which is not real, but if you had to consider also boundary layers and so on, the problem becomes already very complicated. And so I have to solve several differential equations, in particular one for each of the eight species that I'm going to use for representing the problem. And now, I have to make assumptions about how the composition changes. For example, I could assume that since the expansion is fast, the composition doesn't change. So that would be a frozen calculation. I assume frozen kinetics. Composition doesn't change. Well, if I do that, this is the result, which is very far from the actual correct result. Or I could assume that the composition is always the one of chemical equilibrium. It will shift because the system will cool down, so there will be a shifting equilibrium. And this is what it would like. It would look like. Again, not very good. Better, but not very good. Why it is not catching the full story, just the assumption of complete equilibrium along the downstream? Because as you move downstream, some of the reactions are not fast enough to catch up with equilibrium. They're left behind. Because this expansion occurs very quickly, and so not all reactions. You see, some remain with 0 degree of disequilibrium. It means that they satisfy the equation of equilibrium. So we can say that they are at equilibrium. The others, instead, have a degree of disequilibrium that builds up. All right. So this is why neither the completely frozen would not consider that these ones are fast enough to stay at equilibrium, and the completely equilibrium would not consider that these ones get off equilibrium. So we need an intermediate solution. So here is how the as you move downstream, the chemical potential moves off. This is the equilibrium, and they move off and farther away from equilibrium. And you can look, you can project, you can think of this as a sequence of vectors. Just the tip of the vectors moves along this point. And then for each one of them, you can project it down onto the reactive space, and you get this red curve, which describes the degrees of the equilibrium. So now you notice that reactions, apparently in this particular example, behave in groups. They're not all alone, but by studying how the degrees of disequilibrium develop downstream the nozzle, you see that some reactions have exactly the same behavior from that point of view, some others. And if you stare at these curves of a sufficient number of months, at least it took us a few months to realize that this curve up here is the sum of the two below. Sounds very trivial, but we didn't realize it for a while. So here is the interpretation is that in the chemical mechanism, those 24 reactions, there are some bottleneck mechanisms. And those are the things that control the dynamics. And it turns out that some reactions, like these ones, 7, 8, 9, 10, are subject to a given bottleneck mechanism. Some others are subject to another mechanism. Some are not subject to any bottlenecks, and so they equilibrate immediately. They're very fast. And some has to pay the double price. They have to go through both bottlenecks. This is why they have a double delay. They have the delay typical of this bottleneck and the delay typical of this other bottleneck. So this observation can be taken as the idea behind this model reduction strategy that I'm trying to describe. And mathematically, you can, since the curve above is the sum of these two curves, you could write it this way. You write the equation of the two curves below, and then the one on top is the sum of the previous two. Or you can also do it with some other with some coefficients, which in this case are equal to 1, but they could be some other parameters, but fixed parameters. Okay. So now, the local equilibrium assumption is good that we already seen this slide, is good for describing those reactions that remain at equilibrium, that are fast enough to equilibrate very quickly. To describe the fact that some reactions instead are delayed, they're getting thrown off equilibrium, it is sufficient to assume that for every bottleneck mechanism, as associated with it, a constraint equation. This is like a property, some feature of the system that is hard to change, precisely because of that bottleneck. So each bottleneck has a slow varying property associated with it that we call constraint, and which is a linear combination of the composition. So if you assume that these constraints are frozen, you can say, all right, I'm going to assume that the composition of my system at any time during the evolution or at any point downstream the nozzle is the composition that would be at equilibrium if those constraints were also frozen, if the bottlenecks were closed. And so you can find that composition by minimizing again the Gibbs free energy, subject not only to temperature, pressure, and the elements, but also to the values of those constraints. And in your minimization, if you are familiar with the method of Lagrange multipliers, like before, you had one Lagrange multiplier for each of the element constraints. Now you have an additional Lagrange multiplier for each of these rate-controlling constraints. And now if you calculate the DOD, the degree of disequilibrium of the reaction, it's not zero anymore. It is precisely the kind of linear combination that we were looking for, the thing that we needed. If we have two constraints, it will be the sum of two parameters here, which are these curves that we indicated before as gamma. With these B's, these are fixed coefficients for the dynamics. So this is the degrees of disequilibrium, and then since the degrees of disequilibrium can be obtained as the scalar product of the lambda vector with the stoichiometric coefficients, knowing the DODs, I can find the lambda vector by essentially inverting this system of equation. And so I can write the lambda vector, and if I take a picture here now, what is it that we are saying? We are saying that this is the exact trajectory, and it lives in a six-dimensional space, because this plane is a six-dimensional space. But by looking at those curves for the degree of disequilibrium, how they behave, we figure out that in practice, the evolution can be described as evolving in a two-dimensional subspace. I need only two of these vectors here to represent the evolution in an approximate, with a very good approximation. And in fact, if I do that, the result goes precisely, or very, very good on, very well on top on of the exact solution, at least for the temperature trace. Now, don't look at this. I wanted to show you that you can rewrite the balance equations, the differential equations that you want to solve, in terms of these Lagrange multipliers, which we call also constraint potential, one for each constraint. So there are one for each element and one for each of these rate controlling constraints. What is important is the count. How many equations do we have and how many unknowns do we have? The number of differential equations are as many as the elements, so two, because we have hydrogen and oxygen here, as many as the additional constraints, two, because we said that we only need two constraints, and another two for temperature and pressure, so that makes six. And then we have eight algebraic equations, in particular this equation here that can allows you to go from the values of the constraint potentials to the composition, which you need up there to calculate the various properties and so on. And of course, the unknowns are the same number, so you can solve the problem. Now, what is the advantage of having this RCC approximation? That we have reduced the number of differential equations to be solved to only two plus two, so that's six equations. Okay. So if I forget about temperature and pressure, which are always there, it's just the 2 plus 2, which is much less than 8. Well, you will argue that 4 is not much less than 8. That's true, but this example is only for hydrogen and oxygen combustion. If you already go to like methane and air that we've done in either simplified form or in a full scheme for combustion, including formation of nitric oxide, you can see that the savings in number of differential equations is increasing, like go from 29 to 13 in one case, from 53 to 16. Okay, so that's great savings. And the situation gets better, in other words, the improvement becomes significant if you're going to deal with the quote official models for detailed mechanisms for combustion of more complex hydrocarbons. For example, here you have gasoline or isooctane, which is similar, or here you have biodiesel. You see that the number of reactions get into the thousands, and the number of species gets also into the thousands. There is typically a factor of five between the reactions, and the ratio of the reactions of a species is about five. It grows very much. And so it's for this kind of applications that it is almost impossible to solve thousands of differential equations. And so it is very essential for good approximation of turbine combustion applications to have this method, which, by the way, has the advantage of not needing to cut the list of species So you can still take care of computing the minor species. You don't need to cut the reactions. This is not a skeletal method. So you consider the contribution of all reactions, but what is important is that the reactions that contribute the most are those that are, quote, less orthogonal. So it's orthogonal to the constraints. If it is orthogonal to the constraint, even if that reaction has zero projection, so it doesn't contribute. So why is this important? Because as you may know, may guess, if you have thousands of these reactions, you need reaction rates for all of them. And there is a lot of guesswork behind providing those rates. It's not that you can measure or that people have measured all of them. They do all sorts of very nice computations, and people are devoting their entire career in computing these schemes and providing the reaction rates that are mostly, they're better, they're good, but still there is a lot of guesswork. So the fact that, so the method is forgiving in the sense that only the rate controlling, the slope reactions are the most important. So you have to be careful in having good rates for those reactions. And also another thing that I'm particularly fond of is that this method has a built-in thermodynamic consistency, so you don't have to worry about the fact that maybe the entropy production becomes negative. That's forbidden in the method. You don't have to check it, like you should in other methods. So the problem is, well, how then do we find the right constraints? And here comes the catch. This is the reason why I couldn't work further in this method, because you need a chemical kinetics expert to do the to do the guessing. And for example, typical constraints would be the total number of moles. Total number of moles is something that is changed only by reactions like this, where you have three bodies, three molecules that collide, and the result is two products of the reaction. Now, the triple collision is much less probable than two collisions. Collisions of two particles, and so this is unlikely, as occurs at a slow rate, and therefore this is a bottleneck kind of mechanism. Changing the number of moles is slow, and in fact you can define typically a constraint associated with changing the number of moles. Then Professor Keck came out with other more elaborate and more difficult to guess constraints, like also changing the free valence is slow, or changing the free oxygen is slow. In fact, by staring at those curves that we've seen before, you could come up by playing with numbers, just by luck. You can find a way that in addition to the mole conservation constraint, which is this one, a single other constraint can be constructed putting these numbers here. Because then you recognize that this group of reactions has all zeros, so they are all equilibrated and they represent this group. This group of reactions is subject only to the first bottleneck, the three-body reactions, the mole, I mean zero for the other. This other group is subject only to the second bottleneck, because it's zero for the, it's just two-body reactions. And this other book, group is subject to both bottlenecks. So this two apparently are the optimal way to describe this set of curves. And in fact, if you use them, you get excellent results. not only for the temperature, as we have already shown, but also for the minor species. See, if you choose the wrong two constraints, you're not getting the right result. If you choose the optimal set of constraints, you get almost exactly the exact result. Okay. And the differences can be large, especially for the minor species. So how do we identify the right constraints? By staring at the curves. But you see, if you make things a little bit more complicated, for example, if I take the nozzle and I shorten it by a factor of 100, so that the expansion becomes much faster, then many more reactions will get off equilibrium. They will not be fast enough to stay at equilibrium. And here is the picture for a much shorter nozzle. Almost all reactions go off equilibrium. Now, if it took us months to stare at those curves, how many do we need to stare at these ones? We need a mathematical method to look at them. And here is the algorithm. Essentially, it's very simple, thanks to linear algebra. You take those curves here. You represent them in terms of this vector lambda DOD, the red vector that we described before. And at each, this is the entrance, so it's eight numbers. So each column here is one of those vectors. And then you have presumably a grid, you have a numerical simulation. In this case, we have the 1,700 grid points downstream. And so you construct this matrix, which is the solution of a probe full calculation. So you take the full scheme and obtain this matrix. And then what do? Then we use we take that matrix and compute its singular value decomposition. Singular value decomposition, if you look it up in Wikipedia, it takes a matrix and puts it in this form, in which the central part is a diagonal matrix with all zeros except on the diagonal and as many as the rank of that matrix is. In our case, the rank is 6. It's the dimensionality of the reactive space. Okay, so once you've done this decomposition, you use another theorem of linear algebra that says that you can obtain an optimal low rank approximation of the original matrix by essentially neglecting some of these things, some of these numbers in the diagonal, which are called the singular values of the matrix. So if I neglect the small ones, because you see they are ranked by the big one, smaller, much smaller, and so on. If I neglect these four, I get a rank 2 approximation of the original matrix. And that is the basis for obtaining a two constraint approximation. I can even go drastic and keep only the first one. So that would be just single constraint approximation. The last step of the method is to look at these other matrix of the singular value decomposition, which is, by the way, SVD in MATLAB. And you take just the only columns that survive, in this case would be just a single column of this matrix, that would be your constraint. It's the principal axis along this singular value. So if you do, if you take those constraints, here's the result. With two constraints, you go exactly on top of those curves. It's still just two you need. Even if, but even with one, you're not doing that bad. Maybe you're a little off with these reactions here, but you get very close to several of the others. You can apply this method also to more complicated problems. For example, this is a calculation of ignition delay for methane and air in stoichiometric air, starting at a certain temperature and the pressure. So this is differently from the previous problem. You start from very away from equilibrium, and you end up at equilibrium after a long, a relatively long delay in which you need the radicals to build up in order to give rise to the faster, rapid cascade or chain reactions. So this is the exact solution. You see that already with two constraints you get pretty close, but not with good details about the other things. You need to get to 11 constraints to get nice features like this temperature overshoot. The cascade process during the ignition will have you reach a temperature which is higher than the final temperature. Some sort of inertia. You can see here that you can get also the traces of, very well, the traces of the various DODs of the various, of some of the reactions. And also overshoots, you get overshoots of minor species. So the result is good and brings me to the conclusion. So I gave you an overview of the idea that with this method, you, with no need of any deep understanding of the chemical mechanism, provided you have, somebody gives you a chemical mechanism, the algorithm finds optimal constraints to reduce the problem, optimal meaning minimal in number, so that you reduce the differential equations that you have to solve. Of course, it requires that you, once in a while, or at the beginning of your problem, of type of problems, you solve a full DKM, a full solution. And therefore, the method is probably going to be useful only to develop some sort of adaptive strategies, a strategy whereby you compute the full model for a while, use the constraints that come out of it for a while, and then update as you go downstream, as the situation like temperature, pressure, composition changes. Or alternatively, you could compute all possible temperatures, pressures, and compositions that you're interested in, and then interpolate between those and find optimal sets for each of these situations. The other thing is that I would hope that this could become useful also in other fields where we have complex kinetics. And in fact, as part of the future challenges, I would like to see, together with Professor von Spakovsky, what are the relations between this method and his recent advances in the application of the method of steepest entropy ascent, which is part of non-equilibrium thermodynamics modeling. And also for the chemical kinetic people who measure and study those very complex combustion models, maybe this could also help them reduce the number of reactions in to a skeletal situation. With that, I am finished, hopefully in time.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. So are there any questions? Yes,
Bruce. So you can keep your slides back on one or two more slides.
One more?
Maybe one more. Yeah, in here, I think when you mark the TKM, that is the exact solution considered, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you say that you have 2, 5, 8, and 11, is that the selection of the number of constraints?
Yes.
So now you observe that, say, for example, like when I have 2, it's actually that, but when I jump to 5, it's somewhat good, although it didn't capture the over 2. Mm-hmm. But when we go from 5 to 8, it became very bad. So what's the kind of the mechanism behind it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know. I think it has to do with the fact that here we are showing only the temperature. And look at, for example, here, as you go from 5 to 8 for the species, because what you optimize is not much, not only the temperature, but also the entire story, including the species. You see that you go from 5 to 8, and you get significant improvement in the species. So you pay something in the temperature, and you gain in the species. And as you noticed, also, in order, this doesn't catch the overshoot, or maybe not enough. Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah. In all cases, are you using the experimentally determined rate constants for that reaction? Okay, well, very often in some simple kinetic models, they leave out reactions and then they sort of falsify the rate constants for the reaction for other reactions in order to simulate the reactions you're leaving out. Mm-hmm. Right. So, would it be possible to use, let's say, 2 or 5, and adjust the rate constants, fudge them to get better results?
Yes, this is the idea that I was saying that could be used by the people who develop these schemes. Because they decide on what is the set of reactions, say in this case 24 or 325 for 325 for methane, okay, and then they try to adjust the rate constants using all sorts of theories plus some experimental data to fit at best the experimental data. Now, like you are suggesting, precisely as you are suggesting, you could use a calculation like this, not for a single set of conditions, but for a wide set of conditions. So, for example, I would construct the matrix that I'm doing the singular composition, the decomposition, for many different cases. Put them one on the back of the other. So construct a huge matrix of a large set of reactions, of conditions, and then compute constraints for that. So presumably, using this method, I could probably reduce the number of constraints from maybe 53 to maybe 20. So I divided by 2 the complexity of the scheme. And then, of course, I would have to find a way to eliminate some of the reactions also, and then, as you say, fudge or use these results to give rates to those reactions. So it's a program. That what you're describing is very nice, but it would be like a PhD program for a good graduate student.
And then if you fit it to a certain problem you
want to
do, it might, that fit might not work so well for a much different problem.
Yeah. That is why you would need, every model is good for a certain range. No, extrapolation never works in this business. You know, it's better to stay within the boundaries of interpolation. But that's life.
So, any other questions?
Okay, I'd like to ask
question. I'm going to put you on the spot here, and if you don't want to answer it, that's okay. We've sort of been discussing this a little bit. You talked at the end in terms of future direction, how do we tie this into steepest entropy ascent? So most of the people here, other than my graduate students, or people who've had my graduate classes, don't know what we mean by steepest entropy ascent. So could you just give a brief explanation of steepest entropy ascent? What do we mean by that? What's the importance of that? And then any idea, why would steepest entropy ascent somehow be tied into the type of geometry, right, that you showed there? Because if I think of steepest entropy ascent, it's geometry-based as well. Right? Mm-hmm. Some of the brilliance of Professor Beretta here is that he's always thought geometrically. And so in his PhD dissertation, steepest entropy ascent was a geometric construction for an equation of motion. So can you just say a few words on that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the ideas in thermodynamics is that the equilibrium, the stable equilibrium state, is the maximum entropy state. So if you think of entropy, if you think of the entropy surface as a mountain, and the top of the mountain is the stable equilibrium state, and you are in a non-equilibrium state, you are down somewhere. So typically, if a system wants to relax towards equilibrium, it has to climb the mountain, the entropy mountain, and go to the top. So from any point down to the top, you can select many different paths. The steepest ascent path is like the geodetic, it's like it's the shortest. Okay? So you go the steepest path. And so that is the idea behind steepest entropy ascent. There are then some little provisos, though, that, for example, which is very important, is that each system, each material, for example, has its own way of looking at the mountain. It has different glasses. So it's a distorted way of viewing at the same mountain. And so one material could choose, would feel that the steepest ascent direction, the steepest ascent path is one way, because from its lenses, that is how it perceives it. And this lens is geometrically, again, it's the metric that the system uses to measure distances on that mountain. And this metric, for example, in a heat transfer problem, is the thermal conductivity. So the thermal conductivity is in a non-isotropic material is a tensor, and that tensor has the features of a metric, and it is that describes the lens that that material uses to find the path of steepest ascent when it relaxes towards a uniform temperature, which is a stable equilibrium state. Now, the connection with that I see between that method and this one is as follows. If I can, sorry, don't look. I'll tell you when to look. has to do very beginning. Okay, here it is. Yeah. It's the constraints. When you try to do like you have done in many of your applications, calculation, you find that there are so many state variables to be considered that the problem becomes intractable. You need to consider thousands of energy levels and the population of these energy levels, which are the equivalent of these ends, like the state variables here is the number of atoms. In your case, it's the population of the energy levels. Okay. So you could simplify the steepest ascent technology by identifying these constraints, which are slowly varying properties of your system. And I think that this is what your method of hypoequilibrium is doing. You identify subsets of energy levels that
dynamically.
Yes, so that, dynamic. Right. So this is, so that within each subset, the system reaches quickly equilibrium because there are no bottlenecks. The bottleneck is transferring energy from one set of energy levels to another set of energy levels. So those are the right controlling.
Can I ask a question about the question? Yes. So why are you talking about steepest entropy? I don't know anything about this method, but why are you talking about steepest entropy ascent instead of steepest Gibbs energy descent?
Yeah.
Or is it the same? You really mean Gibbs energy when you say entropy?
No. I prefer entropy because I think that entropy is more fundamental. It allows you to describe also truly non-equilibrium states, whereas the Gibbs free energy is minimal, but within a subset of states in which you have defined the temperature and the pressure. So it's
okay. You don't want to have it.
In a general non-equilibrium state, temperature and pressure are not defined.
So you can't define Gibbs free energy. We have extended with the hypoequilibrium, we have extended the equilibrium description to non-equilibrium states where we can define
the entropy of non-equilibrium states.
Yes.
It's easy to describe that, right? Mm-hmm. That's well defined at non-equilibrium and at equilibrium. That's correct. Okay. All right, we need to stop. We're about a couple of minutes over. Thank you for your attention. Professor Barretta is actually here until February 10th. You're welcome to come by if you have any questions to ask, or if you have some additional interest, glad to talk to you. Okay? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.